Get ready for a journey into the heart of Bridgeport politics with In Absentia, a new podcast from Connecticut Public's investigative team, The Accountability Project. Learn about the city's past and present political dysfunction and the systems that enable it. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts.
Funding provided by Joe Zimmel and Valerie Friedman.
On March 11th, 2020, the World Health Organization declared that COVID-19 was a pandemic.
States of emergency have now been declared in 19 states.
The death toll rising here in the U.S. to at least 36, more than 1,200 cases now reported in 42 states and Washington, D.C.
We have no immunity to this virus. We have no vaccines for the virus. Currently, we have no approved treatments for the virus.
In that first year, more than 3 million people die from COVID-19 across the globe. And many of us are still processing what we experienced in those early days of the pandemic. As the world shut down, as kids ask questions that we didn't have answers for, and as we all try to stay safe from a virus that we didn't understand. This is Disrupted. I'm Kalila Brown-Dean. This hour, we're looking back at the 4 years since the pandemic started. We want to understand what we've learned and what we haven't. Now, to be clear, COVID is still with us. Back in January, more than 2,000 people a week were dying from COVID in the U.S. That's according to CDC estimates. And on top of that, many people are still living with the debilitating effects of long COVID. There's no doubt that COVID continues to impact our lives, and it makes it all the more important to think about what's happened since 2020. Later in the show, we'll hear from Dr. Tyson Bell. He's professor of medicine, who'll talk to us about equity in healthcare. But first, we look at the U.S. government's response to COVID-19 in 2020. Scott L. Greer is professor of health management and policy and global public health at the University of Michigan. He's co-editor of the book, Coronavirus Politics. Dr. Greer, it's great to have you on Disrupted.
Thanks for having me.
You are a scholar of health management, of policy and global public health, and that I'm sure prepares you in many different ways to think about coronavirus, but it's a broader context. Talk to us about your background and scholarship that made this pandemic right in that area of interest for you.
Public health alternates between being a thing that interests everybody and a thing that interests nobody. And I was interested in it when it was a really, really strange hobby, because when you think about how societies prepare to deal with really terrible stuff that we don't like to think about, well, the answer is most people don't think about it. So there's a whole world of complicated bureaucracies and technical knowledge that became intensely interesting around about March 2020 that I had always thought were interesting.
The piece of that I'm wondering in this particular context is that when you are looking at a country's response to the pandemic, not just the United States, because that global piece is so key in even understanding how interconnected our fates are in that global way, what are you looking for? What are the kinds of indicators that you are focused on as you're looking at a response?
The first thing is, what kind of a country are you starting with? Because if you're going to face a major infectious disease pandemic, I wouldn't recommend starting with the public health statistics of the United States. I wouldn't recommend starting with our overall bad public health. Our public health as a people was worse in 2019 than Italian public health was in the worst of 2020, when they had army trucks carrying corpses through the streets of Bergamo. So in terms of both health inequalities and overall population health, we didn't start in a great place. And you saw that in our sickness and death. Then there's how good are you at responding, which is a different kind of question. Response is initial. The emergency phase, where you're doing things like trying to close borders and track every case of the disease. And that's a question of public administration and expertise and preparedness. And then, in a lot of pandemics, it's not unusual for them to go on for years. So the third question is, what kind of a society are you as you face something after a year, after 2 years, when the novelty has worn off?
I'm thinking back to where we were in 2020. which some days feel so far removed. And other days, it's like, oh, I remember what it felt like to wash my groceries before they came in the door, or not being sure if I needed to spray down my mail. And I also remember how incredibly impatient we were here in the United States. Why can't you tell me what caused this? Why can't you just wave some wand and fix it and go away? I'm tired of wearing these masks. I'm tired of having to be distant. And as you said, who we were as a people and as a country on the front end had this impact on how we were able to do that. Do you think that the United States was ready for this kind of pandemic? And then I understand that's a loaded concept of what it means to be ready. But were we prepared to deal with this kind of overwhelming, all-encompassing challenge?
3.5 years into the Trump presidency, a president who is distinctive for his ability to make everything about him. It used to be that you could read about the NFL and it wasn't about the president. That changed under the Trump presidency. It used to be that you could read about the weather or storms, and that wasn't about the president. So it landed in a country where it was just on the edge of the enormous partisan political conflagration we saw in 2020. So we weren't in a great place, even by American standards, when we started. It's also something you highlighted. By any historical standards, this was an incredible triumph of fast science. We had that virus isolated in January of 2020. It was pretty obvious, barring a disaster, that we would have really good mRNA vaccines within 14 months and normal vaccines on the same schedule. It, compared to anything, compared to, for example, HIV, where it took us practically 10 years to identify the disease, let alone the virus, and we still haven't found an effective vaccine. This was an absolute triumph of the speed of science. People essentially, for the whole of human history, would envy us our ability to figure out so quickly what to do.
I think I might know the answer to this question, but I don't want to make any assumptions. How would you characterize our response in terms of the leadership response or lack of response in those earliest stages to be able to say to people, we are prepared for this, we have to let this play out?
Well, here's the rule. Successful U.S. response to any kind of a disaster depends on federal leadership. And federal leadership depends on White House leadership. There's a single point of failure in the entire system, and it's the presidency. Because without the presidency, the federal government doesn't self-coordinate. And without the federal government, the states don't have the resources or the abilities to effectively coordinate. So we had a system set up in which you had to have an engaged president who was committed to leading and committed to a particular policy agenda. And I think we all know that we didn't have that. It started off with what you might call a period of confusion, where President Trump really couldn't seem to decide what he wanted to do with the pandemic. He wanted it to go away, obviously. But it turned into something that you see with particular intensity in the United States. It's mostly confined to the far right in other countries, which is an explicit politicization of public health, an explicit connection between a given political identity and denying things like the effectiveness of vaccines and the effectiveness of public health measures. And that's unusual in the United States in its intensity. Brazil's probably the only other country where you've seen it.
In the United States, you said we need this federal response, federal leadership. I'm also curious about how federalism plays out here, where not only did you have 50 different state responses, in some states, it was different based on what part of the state you lived in and how those kinds of differences played out too. How do you think that showed up in understanding big country, lots of different decision makers, as well as these internal state level dynamics?
Part of it is that you are going to have differentiation because the pandemic hit differently, as you say, in different parts of the country. So in Michigan, for a lot of 2020, Detroit was in really bad shape. But if I were to get in my car and drive 600 miles to the Upper Peninsula, zero cases, and they want to know why their supermarket is closed. Or put another way, 10 million people. That's about the population of Sweden, which is the middle country in the among EU member states. 10 million is also about the population of Michigan or North Carolina, and it's also the population of Los Angeles County in California. So, of course, Sweden had a more coherent response than the United States. And of course, California had a less coherent response than Sweden, because California's got a county with as many people as a lot of the world's countries.
I'm curious, Scott, as you looked at other countries and their responses, how did those dimensions of partisanship, of polarization, the politics of it, how did that play out and how other countries responded or addressed the pandemic?
Politicians care about credit and blame. They want credit for good things, like being a hero and saving their population, and they want to avoid blame for bad things, like mass death or mask rules. So what happened in the pandemic was that in most countries, early on, politicians dived in. It's time to be a hero. They did really dramatic actions. But then the mainstream parties started to back off and look for ways to just get us through to when the vaccines would arrive. Now, parties on the right and the far right had a different problem, because they really didn't have anything to say about health. They had things to say about immigration. They had things to say about race. They had things to say about crime. They didn't have a lot to say about public health. But over time, they found their groove, and what they wanted to talk about was how offensive it was to small businesses and freedom-loving citizens that the bar was closed and they had to wear a mask on their face. The difference is that in most countries, these forces are pretty marginal. You can find somebody saying this in Austria, Germany, France, but basically you don't see people in the government saying it. You don't have government parties that are out there giving straight-up anti-vaccine, anti-mask messages. That's where the United States is in a very select club globally.
It is, I'll just be completely candid here. I'll step away from my objective academic political scientist perspective. It is both infuriating and sad in some ways of how our need to quickly move on to the next thing could have actually contributed to the problem. And the other piece that infuriates me about this, Scott, is how many people seemed shocked during the pandemic that there were these wide-scale inequalities that exist. That if schools close, that means some kids don't have access to a meal. If things shut down, it means that some people don't have access to shelter, to stay warm or to stay cool, and that our big environmental challenges that we know existed pre-COVID had an impact on who was most affected and most likely to suffer in this. How did that notion of inequality play out for other countries in either the response or the impact of the pandemic?
The rich countries mostly stumbled into, and the US is included here actually, mostly stumbled into the right answer, which is pay people to stay home, pay businesses to go into cold storage. And there was variation. It was a lot easier to go on a holiday in April 2020 in the United States than it would have been to go on a holiday in Italy or Spain. But basically, curb the spread by paying people to stay home. And that's what we remember best. And the problem is, of course, that you need to think about the details. So, for example, this is based only on data from California because they collect that kind of data. It looks like probably the most dangerous job in the pandemic was a line cook in a restaurant. Because look at the kitchen area of a given restaurant that does takeaway and delivery. Look at the ventilation. Look who's working in there. Look at the hours they're working. And look at the fact that they kept going and did much bigger business when a whole lot of more fortunate people were at home. So that was the kind of inequality that mattered. And that was the one that was in many ways hardest to manage for every society. The other kind is anywhere that a lot of people live in close proximity: prisons, nursing homes, dormitories, the army. And so in country after country, for example, slaughterhouses turned out to be really, really big problems. Because we wanted our meat. The Trump presidency declared that, unlike, say, medical equipment, a problem of national security. And slaughterhouses turn out to be fantastic places for the workers to communicate disease to each other. German slaughterhouses are a little bit safer than American slaughterhouses, but frankly, mass vegetarianism would have saved some lives if we'd done it for a couple of months.
Again, how do we respond to the idea that these choices, these things that in the grand scheme of things may have made us change a little bit or may have been uncomfortable at first, could have had these sort of broad consequences that would have served not just the public interest, but even our individual interests. So Scott, I need you to give me some hope as we think about this conversation. Do you think we have learned from what we went through? Do you think that the U.S. may be better positioned to prepare or to address the next pandemic? Because we know that's the reality. Not if, but when the next pandemic. Come on, Scott, give me a little hope.
You asked for hope and an answer. Which one do you want first?
Okay, give me the real answer. Are we prepared for the next pandemic?
No, I think we're worse off. Three reasons. One, it's now a problem of partisan politics. Look down at Florida right now. Ron DeSantis' Surgeon General is essentially saying that vaccines for measles should be optional. And measles is a terrifying disease, high fatality, extremely contagious. And you can't effectively vaccinate kids until 18 months for it. So he's exposing babies of parents who would love to get them vaccinated to a terrible, terrible disease. That is part of what was until recently an effort to become the Republican nominee for president. That is a partisan gambit, and it fits with a party whose elites are increasingly telling its voters that public health measures and vaccines are bad. Well, second reason, that partisanship started to matter. So, for example, we've weakened our laws. There's tracking projects that count all the different ways that partisan Republican courts and partisan Republican legislatures have been removing public health mandates, such as quarantine rules, abilities to close businesses during a public health emergency, or even vaccination rules. And the third thing is the poor public health workforce is mostly local civil servants who start in jobs like trainee septic inspector. Like, really, they're doing good work, and it's not always fun, glamorous, or well paid. And by any indicator, they've been traumatized. High levels of physical violent threats to them, efforts to cut their funding, people running against them, people being rude to them socially. So we are driving the workforce into the ground. They're in bad shape and they're not getting the support and help and replacements that they need. We're removing the legal codes that would make it possible to respond effectively. We have a couple of states with effectively no emergency powers left now. For example, nice, clean Wisconsin is going to be a dangerous place. And it's all because of this underlying decision that we were going to politicize and make partisan the basic concept of public health, of protecting yourself while protecting others. That's something that is now your partisan identity. And in an America as polarized and as partisan as the United States today, it's really dangerous if half the population is getting the message from their leaders that public health is a bad idea.
As we are leading up to the 2024 or part of the 2024 election cycle, and I know that many people are focused on the race for the White House, and that's important, but there are also a lot of important decisions that will be made at the state and local level that feed into this vortex of chaos that you're mentioning as well. What is an issue or an area where you're saying voters should focus on this, not for whom they should vote or how they should vote, but this is an area that can feed into, as you're saying, why the failure to address public health in this collective way could be disastrous. Is there an area where you say voters should pay attention here?
The healthcare workforce, not just the public health workforce, you know, not just the fact that we're driving county public health leaders out of the business, but in general, the healthcare workforce. A lot of them retired. It's getting harder and harder to find a doctor or a nurse. People aren't necessarily going into jobs like respiratory technician because they saw how we treated the respiratory techs during the pandemic. We are creating a healthcare workforce crisis that we don't need to have. We have an aging healthcare workforce, and a lot of them are saying they're going to leave. We have a healthcare workforce that is, if they're going to continue working, they're really angry. And we're not trying to recruit new people by treating them this way. And when you start to have a workforce crisis, obviously, the people who need the healthcare the most are going to suffer the most. Because if I'm a doctor in a place of shortage, I'm going to treat the patients with the nicest insurance. So much of this rolls together into if you pay healthcare providers, if you invest in education, if you invest in policies that reach out to all sorts of more vulnerable communities, if you think hard about having a healthcare system that will serve us and will give us the healthcare that we need, that wraps a whole lot of problems together, from reproductive rights to public health to your ability to get an appointment with a doctor in less than 6 months.
So many dynamics to that, and I'm thinking of all the ways that the previous election tried to pit suburban interests versus urban interests, rural versus whatever. And what you've just laid out for us is that this is a collective public health crisis that requires a collective response in order to change it. Scott L. Greer is professor of health management and policy and global public health at the University of Michigan. He's co-editor of the book Coronavirus Politics. Professor, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. This was great.
Coming up, a professor of medicine will share his experience of 2020, including what surprised him at the start of the pandemic. This is Disrupted. Stay with us.
Support for this podcast comes from Hartford HealthCare.
Elevating Health is funded by Hartford HealthCare. Loneliness can be a significant health risk to people of all ages. Dr. Laura Saunders, a psychologist from Hartford HealthCare's Institute of Living, talks about social isolation and why we need to connect in person.
Loneliness actually is a pretty significant health risk for people that struggle with social isolation. It affects their blood pressure, it affects their immune system, it affects your willingness to get up and get out, and can cause some not just emotional issues, but health problems as well.
You're not alone. Dr. Saunders explains how important it is for us to look to others and get out of our comfort zone.
I like to talk about social isolation as not just that individual's problem, but it's a community problem or it's a family problem. We need to connect with others. We can take space at times as well, but we need to step out of our comfort zone and do things to connect with other people. It's life-saving.
For more information, go to ctpublic.org/elevatinghealth.
Welcome back to Disrupted. I'm Kalila Brown-Dean. Today, we're reflecting on the 4 years since COVID-19 was officially declared a pandemic. Early on, there was a lot of conversation about who was bearing the brunt of the pandemic. Black Americans were twice as likely as white Americans to be hospitalized with COVID between March 2020 and May 2023. The rates for people who are American Indian or Alaska Native were even higher. That's according to data from the CDC. COVID-19 shed light on existing health disparities. At a recent Connecticut public event in Norwalk, Dr. Uche Blackstock spoke about her new book, Legacy, A Black Physician Reckons with Racism in Medicine. One of the topics she discussed was the inequities that persist in U.S. healthcare.
I also quote this another set of research that shows that even for Black immigrants that come to this country, when they come here, their health outcomes are on par to that of white Americans. Literally, after a generation of being here, their outcomes have dropped to that of Black Americans. So I use those examples because often, even in how we're taught, how I was taught in medical school, we're taught that there's something intrinsically wrong with Black people. And there is nothing wrong with us at all. There is something very, very wrong with the social systems and institutions that we live and work within in this country.
For more on health equity and to share his experiences of the pandemic, we're joined now by Dr. Tyson Bell. He's Associate Professor of Medicine at the University of Virginia. Dr. Bell, welcome to Disrupted.
Thank you for having me.
You know, before we talk about the pandemic and your role in helping to keep people safe, I want to ask you a more basic question, and that is, what led you to pursue a career in medicine?
Oh, that goes way back. So I was we grew up in the same hometown, Lynchburg, Virginia, And I was a child with severe asthma, and I went to the doctor's office pretty frequently to my pediatrician. And I remember being around 3 or 4 years old and having been in a routine of seeing so many healthcare professionals, even at that point, just telling them that I think I want to be a doctor one day. And the staff there, the doctors and nurses, really fed into that dream and let me follow them around and see other patients. And I talked to children about getting vaccinations even back then. And I think that's where it started. And luckily for me, I held on to that dream and I had good people to help guide me along the way. So it started back in childhood. And luckily for me, I was able to achieve that dream.
It's hard to believe that we are now 4 years since the start of the pandemic. But I'm curious where you were back in that 2019-2020 phase when the pandemic started. Where were you in your career and in your journey?
Well, I was a relatively new faculty member at UVA. I had finished all of my training in 2017, and I was just kind of getting my bearings. So I had been here long enough that I knew where all the bathrooms were, but I still hadn't quite figured out what exactly do I want to do in my career. And I had this combined training between critical care and ICU and infectious diseases, and I wasn't quite sure what that was going to look like. And then comes along this novel coronavirus that is causing people to go into the ICU, and it's a viral illness. And so many of these concepts that I've been spending my life studying all of a sudden come together at one. And it wasn't even the scientific part of it, but this clearly was a disease that was adversely affecting African American and other marginalized populations, a community that I come from, and people who were frontline workers, which many people in my family were. So there were so many different ways that this intersected with both my professional and personal life that it really was a moment that was a life changer for me.
Were you surprised at the beginning of how rapidly this developed, or the ways that it developed, that maybe at the beginning people thought, you know, yeah, it's going to be a little uncomfortable? But what was most surprising to you at the beginning phases of the pandemic?
Well, I think like many people, I'll be honest, I did not foresee a global pandemic that was going to upend everyone's life. I thought that this was probably going to go the way of the earlier version of SARS-CoV-1 that hit in Asia, and certainly was a big problem. It didn't become a worldwide sort of issue the way that COVID-19 did. And so I kind of thought maybe a year where we'd have to kind of maybe do some mitigation measures. And I think the moment for me was seeing what was happening in New York City. I had gone to medical school at Columbia and had lots of colleagues who were there. And if you've ever spent time in New York City or lived there, you know it's just a pace of, you know, it's just busy, lots of people, lots of hustle and bustle. And to see the streets empty in broad daylight, that was a surreal moment where I realized this is going to change things. And we really have to pull out all the stops when it comes to trying to stop the spread.
Let me ask a more personal question, and that is, how do you prepare to do this every day? You are dealing with something that in our lifetime, we had not dealt with in terms of the magnitude of this. It's personal for you because you understand their risk for you, their risk that members of your family, people you care about face, and you are called to deliver in an environment that is uncertain. What was that like for you to go in every day knowing that the risks were tremendously high, but you felt compelled to assist?
Well, it's interesting you asked that because I had some mixed feelings about it because I certainly have a role to protect health. You know, if someone goes down in the street or I'm in an arena, I'm the person who comes to help them. And so it was natural for me to step into that role from a healthcare standpoint, but that's not dissimilar from what many other people in society do. Teachers who go to school, my dad's a bus driver, and I remember the case of the Detroit bus driver who caught COVID-19 and died after a passenger coughed in his face. My dad continued to show up to work and drive people on his daily route. my mom was a cashier at Target, and she continued as an essential worker, continued to go to work. And there was a point where I realized that, yes, I'm exposing myself every day to patients with COVID-19, and I'm putting breathing tubes in and have all the risks, but I also have the most optimal PPE. I have an N95, I have gowns, I have good ventilation where I work. And I felt at one point that I actually feel like I'm safer than many people who don't have this protection. And so I think it's more of a factor of people tend to step up and do what they need to do in moments where they need to do them. And I fell into that. But what became scary for me was realizing that so many other people around the country, around the world were also doing this, but may not have the resources and ability to protect themselves that I did.
You know, I remember those early phases where the words were social distancing, right? And the need to stay safe by staying away from people. And I also remember, Tyson, my frustration that there were so many people for whom that was a luxury that they could not do. Often the people who were taking care of others, of thinking of home health aides who had to put themselves at risk, not making much money to do it and not having the equipment. And then we also think about the very vulnerable population of children, particularly school children. What were your thoughts on that decision to totally lock down schools and all of the politicized debates about whether to keep schools open or closed?
I would say this was the most challenging part of managing the pandemic, what to do with schools and children. And I had a beginning of the pandemic, I had a 4 to 5 year old who was just started kindergarten, and I had one in preschool. And just like every other parent, I was afraid at the beginning and worried that my kids were going to be exposed and catch COVID-19. And we didn't know much about it at that point, the effect in children versus adults. And I think many of us agree with shutting down schools at that point. But I think what became difficult is that we don't understand schools as a critical part of infrastructure in this society. Schools are like a bridge that's critical to get someone to work. If that bridge is out, you may not be able to get to work, or you're going to be delayed. And similarly, if school is out, society does not have the capacity to work or get things done. And having kids out of school presented a whole other list of problems, from social emotional development, the fact that many children depend on school to provide meals, like I did when I went to public school. And so how do you account for making sure that children stay safe and are able to learn, but also parents have the infrastructure that they need in order to work and do what they need to do? It was tough, and I wish I had the answers, but it needs to continue to be something that we work on in society.
What I hear from you is these were not easy decisions. There were competing factors, sometimes competing interests. And I'm not convinced that we always allowed space for nuance and context in those moments of deciding what was best. And you're also mentioning those social determinants, that it wasn't just about the medical provision. There were all of these interconnected factors that voices like yours, like Dr. Marcella Nunes Smith, Uche Blackstock, Ayla Stanford, were raising to say, you know, it's unfortunate that it took this pandemic for people to realize it, but let's talk about health equity in a very different way. What do you think we've learned about health equity and the need to center those social determinants through this pandemic?
I think that for folks who have been paying attention to healthcare in America and across the globe, that COVID-19 really was a new set of glasses or a new lens through which to view the same problems that have been plaguing us. In that health is so integrated with so many aspects of our daily life. You know, health is certainly new therapeutics and drugs and pharmacies and primary care offices, but it's also the environment that's around you when you walk outside. Is there tree cover? Is it safe to walk around? There's fascinating research showing that just an hour away from me in Richmond, Virginia, in the summertime, in the urbanized areas, it's actually hotter. The atmosphere is hotter when you walk around, and there's a higher risk of heat stroke in these areas. And these are also communities that have low access to air conditioning and cooling stations. And so heat-related deaths are higher in those communities versus in tree cover. That's also public health. So I think the conversation hopefully is elevated to the sense that we understand public health more in the context of our daily life and so many different things that are structurally based that we have to work on and correct in order to make sure that people are as healthy as they can be, because we can see, unfortunately, what those consequences are in the context of COVID.
Coming up, more from Dr. Tyson Bell. He'll share how some people's political identities can shape their decision-making around COVID protections. This is Disrupted. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Disrupted. I'm Kalila Brown-Dean. This hour, we're looking at the lessons we've learned from the responses to COVID-19. I've been talking with Dr. Tyson Bell, Associate Professor of Medicine at the University of Virginia, about health equity. Ask Dr. Bell if we've made the structural changes that we need in terms of healthcare access.
Well, I wish I could say I've seen changes or at least moving towards that change, but I really haven't. And it gets to the fact that structural change is so hard. When I'm talking to my medical students and residents, and we talk about how difficult it is to change structure, we talk about, you know, going to Target or Walmart or wherever you go on a weekly basis, there's probably a certain way that you get there because the structure of the roads are constructed such that that's the most convenient way to go. And there might be a better way to get there, but you're kind of in your routine and you feel comfortable stepping out of that routine. And so when we think about that in the context of, you know, where are our pharmacies, where are our health clinics, where are the crucial things that we need to live on a day-to-day and week-to-week basis, our grocery stores, is there access to healthy food? I went back and looked in my community for a health equity talk that I gave, and just did a Google map and outline where were the pharmacies in my neighborhood and where were the grocery stores in my neighborhood, and they were absolutely zero. And this was a population center in Lynchburg, Virginia, where a high concentration of people lived, but we had to go outside of our community to get fresh fruits and vegetables and to get our medicines. And so that is something that if it's not pointed out and you're not thinking actively about it, you may not even see it. It's like you don't have the corrective lens to which to view equity. And so when we say things like we should have vaccines freely available at pharmacies, that sounds like a great idea. But if you walk around my community where I grew up, that is not a solution because they aren't there. And so we have to constantly ask this question, the things that we assume, the assumptions that we make about what's best for public health in the community, we need to make sure that it works for the people with the least amount of access. And if we start there and ask those questions, I think we can arrive at better solutions.
You have been part of efforts locally, regionally, nationally, globally even, to raise these issues. And I wonder, Tyson, how this has affected you as a person, as a human, not just as a doctor, but as the father who wants a better future for your children, but really for all children. How do you think this pandemic, the consequences of it, have affected you?
Oh, that's a deep question. I think like so many of us, the pandemic has forced me to think about what are the most important things in life and what are my priorities. I think this was a moment where so many of us stepped outside of our normal routine and existence and contemplated things like our own mortality and or maybe even experience that in our families. It really helps you center what is the most important. And I would say for me, it's trying, continuing to show up as a physician for my patients, trying to be the best husband and father I can be, and realizing that our time on earth is limited and we have to make the most of our efforts. I always try to center my patients, and you know, for all the problems that we talk about in society, you could think about how are you going to change the world? How are you going to make it a better place? And the lucky part for my profession is it could start with one patient. If I could make one outcome for one patient better, I can feel good about my day. I can feel good about what I'm doing. It's about these small victories that, yes, we have large problems. We have huge hills to climb, but in order to conquer these hills, we have to take one step at a time.
One of the hills that we will have to climb is thinking about how we prepare collectively, not just individually, but collectively for the next pandemic or for the next major public health challenge. What will you say to our listeners about things that they should either pay attention to, do, or center in their thinking as we prepare?
Well, there's a saying I use when I'm working in the ICU with my trainees is that we should try to plan our drama ahead of time, because things can be unpredictable, but oftentimes we can anticipate what might happen with a patient or with a family, and we can plan for what we're going to do in that circumstance. So I would say we need to take the lessons of COVID-19 and think about what's the drama that we can plan for ahead of time so that we can have infrastructure erected or rapidly able to be deployed, so that we don't go through this the same way that we did the last time. I think a crucial part of this is laying a stronger public health infrastructure so that we have better systems around pandemic response. So things like rapid surveillance testing and global testing, erecting vaccination centers, therapeutic trials, and making sure that we are integrated into the community so that we know which populations are going to be at higher risk if a pandemic breaks out. We have good cohesive communication between local, state, national public health entities so that we're not speaking different languages when we're sharing data. And we can rapidly communicate to the health, to the public about what's happening and what we know at this point. I think if we focus on trying to lay the framework for the things that we know we'll have to do, the last part, the uncertainty part, is a little bit easier because we've at least laid the groundwork.
One of the ways that groundwork is happening is a direct result of your efforts, and that is thinking about clinical trials for treatment of COVID-19. You were very instrumental in bringing those clinical trials to UVA, but really being an advocate for it. And Tyson, I mention you in our household often because I have a high school sophomore who wants to be a doctor. And one of the things that she's really focused on is clinical trials and access and being more representative in who has access to those trials, but the different ways that we know these things work. So if your ears ever burn, it's because we're mentioning you in the household. Talk to us about that work of bringing those clinical trials to UVA and why you thought it was so important in laying that kind of groundwork of preparing, but also thinking about treatment.
A really great question. Clinical trials is very important to ensure health equity because we want to make sure that we have access to therapeutics and the latest technologies and therapeutics that are available to communities that have low access. I work in an academic medical center where a core mission centers around clinical care, education, and research. And health equity should be a part of all of these things because ultimately, at the end of the day, we serve the community that's around us, and many people in the community work at our medical center. And so we have to do right by them. And I think it needs to be a part of every part of our mission. It needs to be integrated as we think about equity. It should be as simple as walking one foot in front of the other, as brushing your teeth in the morning, that anything that we do, we have an equity focus to it. And it's a really timely question because just last evening I was on a Zoom, public facing Zoom, where we were talking about the importance of clinical trials in our community. And the thing about research, this is, it can be such a hot topic in marginalized communities, and particularly the Black community, because of Tuskegee and the earned mistrust that the medical care has earned from particularly Black Americans in the society because of past atrocities. So we have to be sensitive when we approach about clinical trials, but we also have to understand what the concerns are, and that this is a part of empowering patients to understand their health and to make good decisions about how to steward their health going forward. And so we have to approach with cultural sensitivity, with understanding of that history, and knowing that we need to provide this access, even though it might be a little harder to do this because there's some mistrust there, but it's very much a part of moving forward with the community and sharing those results and giving feedback and asking questions like, did you feel like this was a good experience? Did you feel protected?
As you were talking about that phrase, I had to write it down, earned mistrust. And we think about earned mistrust in the medical field, in research and trials. And I also think, Tyson, we think about it in politics as well. We are heading into the 2024 election cycle. We're already in it, but building up to an election where I think that earned mistrust around the response to this pandemic, the ways that it was politicized, the ways that basic things like health became so partisan and politicized. What are you thinking about as a physician who was on the front lines, very much been involved in this heading into the election? You know, what does that mean for you about the need to address the earned mistrust, but also making sure people are making healthy decisions that aren't just based on politics?
You know, what's so fascinating about COVID-19 is that it became so heavily politicized that it was a value signal how you were managing the pandemic. There was a point where if you were wearing a mask outdoors in a public space, it was perceived as a signal that you were on one side or the other, when it really could have been a patient who was immune compromised and was just trying to protect themselves. And it played out so specifically with COVID-19 that even in the midst of things that were happening around COVID-19, we saw that disparity. So for instance, I saw a poll that showed that there's more trust in the RSV vaccine that came out just a few months ago than the COVID-19 vaccines that have been available for years now and have been given to billions of people. So an actual new vaccine has more trust than established COVID-19 vaccines. And on that theme for RSV, 40% of babies this season received the monoclonal antibody, the new monoclonal antibody for RSV. So clearly, if something becomes politicized, then it can fall into the are you with us or against us sort of mantra. But we do have to do some work in public health on trying to rise above the politics of it, because it really, this was a disease that did not discriminate against anyone. Everyone was fair game. And you saw moments where the politics interfere with that ability for people to make good decisions because they were so caught up in their identity. I remember having conversations with patients who wanted to get vaccinated, but they were afraid that they would be ostracized in their family for making that decision. We have to think about ways that we can talk about health without inflaming the divisions that tend to silo us off. And that might mean crafting our message for specific communities. It might mean finding the right person to message, because oftentimes the best person to vouch for a healthcare professional might be a leader in that community. And, you know, certainly when I had conversations with African Americans about the vaccine, they were different in nature than when my other colleagues had those conversations. So we have to think carefully about how we select our messages, who's the messenger, and who are we using in a community to forge more trust so that we can rise above the politics.
You are incredibly thoughtful. You're incredibly thoughtful and successful and dedicated. And I imagine that that also can come with kind of a weight to it. So my last question is, what is it that brings you joy?
I think what brings me joy is that at my heart, I'm still that three-year-old boy who dreamed of becoming a physician and wasn't sure if I was going to make it. But by stroke of luck or God intervention, I was able to make it. So on a day-to-day basis, I'm living out my dream and doing what I felt I was put on this earth to do. And that's what brings me joy, honestly.
We are so glad that you're living out your dream. You are pursuing your purpose and you are creating opportunities for so many people. Dr. Tyson Bell is Associate Professor of Medicine at the University of Virginia. Thank you again.
Thank you.
Disrupted is produced by Kevin Chang Barnum, Wayne Edwards, Meg Dalton, and Katie Tularski. Our interns are Scout Raimundo and Sajina Shrestha. You can listen to all the previous episodes of Disrupted by finding us wherever you get your podcast. I'm Kalila Brown-Dean. Thanks for listening.